Some people here still for the show. So I've learned, somebody said the other day, I forgot who, that you need to catch the interest of the audience before you start. Here's a device that can factor 15 using Shor's algorithm. A physical device that does it actually better than the quantum devices that we see in the literature. Okay? Or I should say, here's a device that does that. You can send it around. That's a Fredkin gate. Here's a measurement device. Sorry?
It has to come back.
Oh, yeah. Please send it back to the front. So I'll show this. I'll come back to this at the end. So first I'll talk a bit about a concept of non-contextuality that some people and I devised, Ekeberg Svarov and Janne Kujala. I'll also talk a bit about memory requirements for simulating contextuality. That's Otfried, Gyne, Matthias Kleinmann, José Ramón Portillo, Constantino Bedroni, Adán Cabello, and then I'll talk about this simulation of quantum computers with Niklas Johansson and Patrick Harrison and myself. FQXI sponsored part of this work, the memory stuff for quantum contextuality. Right. I was hoping I'll just say one controversial thing today, but there might be two, actually. I'll start with why I think that measurements that occur in two different contexts actually don't need to be the same measurement. Okay, so I'll just briefly touch that. I said no yesterday, decisively, in the discussion, and I'd like to just say something about why I said no. You all recognize this kind of picture, Stan Garrett device. You can't measure these three simultaneously, but you can measure these three simultaneously, the squares. These are actually these are quadrupole moment measurements, while these are dipole moment measurements. Okay. You can diagonalize the spin squared operators, so it's evident that you can measure them at the same time. And you can sort of vary the directions here of x and y while keeping the z direction straight. And you say, okay, so we assign the value to the z direction, the same value in both contexts. Yeah? And you were saying, most experimentalists tell you that the measurement here must be the same as the measurement there. And I'm saying, no, that's not actually what's going on. What you're doing is a quadrupole moment measurement, and that tells you what axis contains the zero. Yeah? You specify three axes, and it tells you what axis contains the zero. That's what you do in the measurement, at least if you do it with a quadrupole measurement, moment measurement. In the Peres-Mermin square, you measure a whole context. Yeah? That's what you did on your slide. You measured a whole context, and then you said, okay, one measurement here will be I ignore one result. The other measurement will be I ignore the other result. And the third one is I combine the two in a special manner and I throw away the extra information. Yeah. And then you had another context where you measured in a different way, and I think you measured that one directly. So you throw away one of the results and you keep the product of the product measurement. And to me, those are different measurements. And I suppose I would argue that it should be to you too, but you said, no, they are the same. The projectors here represent the same thing because I have the same statistics. To me, the statistics is a good argument that these are, in fact, the same thing, but that's not what I'm after. I'm after some reason to assign the same value for the two different things. Yeah? And then use that as basis for my argument. So you can use statistics, or you could use something else. For example, you could say, okay, so I've learned here which direction contains the zero. And since this measurement actually commutes with that measurement, the projector around here commutes with the spin measurement. Yeah? I could argue that, okay, so these things have individual existence, and they have to be equal. I expect to, if I get a zero here, measurement of z would tell me I could predict or use counterfactual reasoning to say, okay, so the measurement of the spin dipole moment must be zero. Yeah. Now the crucial point here is that this thing here doesn't have a context in that sense. You can only ever specify one direction. You can't really talk about the other two because you don't use it in the measurement. It's not there. And if you try, you will immediately end up in something which doesn't commute even with this measurement. If you try to talk about spin Z measurements together with X or Y, it doesn't work.
I don't know if this is exactly what you're saying, but there is a projective measurement which is the zero component for X, zero component for Y, and zero component for Z.
Yes. Yes. What's that?
So you can say which of
yes.
the three am I in the zero component?
Yes, but that's this measurement here. I'm talking about you link it to.
No. So I'm talking about the one I'm thinking about would not be diagonal in a standard basis. So if I project her onto mz equals zero.
Yes.
Project her onto mx equals zero.
Yes.
Project her onto my zero. That forms a different orthogonal basis than the one you've diagonalized these operators in.
Well, this one is diagonal in the same. I'm not sure what you're alluding to. I think I'll just, we'll talk about that later, okay? I want to make the point that the underlying reasoning for me is that there are, I mean, pre-existing values that you actually reveal. And these link, so this is the link between context where Z is the same, but X and Y are different. So you link it through that. Not via measurements being the same, because they're not. They're different procedures. But still, you expect them to give the same result. You always talk about statistics, and I like to talk about pre-existing values instead. So that's the reasoning that I'm using. Okay? I was going to mention something about an extended notion of contextuality. So this you all know, the Kliashko pentagon. This is the using the directions in the original proof. There's an inequality like that. And you assume, to get to this, you assume that there are pre-existing values and that measurement of A4 here doesn't depend on which context it's in. You prove this inequality, the quantum mechanical quantum mechanical prediction is this, and then you do an experiment, and this looks horribly complicated. The experiment is really from Fisher of Letters 2011, and you get all of these numbers, and at the end of the day you derive, well, the measurement is like this either. So plus one is if you get a click here, minus one is if you get a click here. If you get a click anywhere else, A1 is plus one. A2 is minus one if you get a click here. If you get a click anywhere else, it's plus one. You got one photon, three paths. So you always get one out of three results, but never the fourth result. So the first row here is really the data from that. And you add some piece of glass. You get a different operator here, well, a different measurement. This one stays the same. because you didn't do anything. And then you just add. And now you're at the end. You recover something which isn't exactly A1. You get A1 prime at the end as a measurement. And then you do some complicated evaluation of whether these things are equal or not. So you look at probabilities of A1 prime equals A1 and things like that. But what I was going to point to is that these measurements, it's a difficult thing, and it's non-ideal in many senses. One thing that can happen is that the transformations that you want aren't ideal. So you go from A1 to A3 by adding this piece of glass, but you don't get exactly A3. And I proposed a measure of precision many years ago, but I didn't actually link that to measurable quantities. You used a number of contexts and the number of rotations, the number of changes of context, and then you derive a bound. But at the time, I had no idea how to connect it to measurable quantities. If you want to read more about it, Andreas Winter actually did something that connects this epsilon to measurement data. The trouble I'm seeing here is that he used the quantum mechanical effect. He basically proposes that you do quantum tomography on the transformation. You derive some estimate of this epsilon, and then you use that in your bound. My problem is that the notion of non-contextuality is actually not quantum. It's a classical notion. So my question is, why would the notion of quantum mechanical distance, the distance from the ideal thing to the actual thing you have any effect whatsoever?
How do you feel about using tomography in generalized probabilistic theories?
I'll pass on that, because that will take us into a discussion that won't end until late.
So good, bad, you feel bad about it?
I'm undecided at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's why there will be a long discussion. Okay, so what I found together with Ektibar and Janne was that there's actually another problem here, not just that these things are inexact. When you add T3, expecting A4 to stay the same, you can actually see in the measurement data that in context 3, you've got one value for the average, and in context 4, you get another. These are actually, if you do a statistical test here, these are different at 1% significance, which is really low, so you would say these are not the same measurement. I think even you would say these are not the same measurement. And then of course they should be equal, because non-contextuality here implies that they are equal. Yeah? And then the authors of this paper, I tell them that there's something fishy going on, and they ask me, what do I do about that? Yeah? So then I must come up with something. And what happens, what we did was, we proposed this remedy. The probability that the same thing with the same index, not necessarily the same measurement, these things you want to be the same, but they're not. The probability that you don't get the same outcome is larger than the trace distance or total variation distance. Yeah. A non-contextual model has both of these zero, so it still applies. So what we proposed was that you use the term maximal non-contextuality when the probability equals the trace distance between the marginals. And that's actually saying, well, the noise isn't fundamental to the thing. It's just happenstance. And I have to tell Rob here, I'm not particularly satisfied with this solution either, but it's the least invasive extra thing you can put on non-contextual models, because you actually are saturating the bound that you can prove from basically no information other than I would like these to be equal. How do I do that? So now when you have this assumption, I should say non-contextuality is an assumption that I use to prove a theorem. Now I can use this assumption, maximal non-contextuality, and prove another theorem. If you have a maximally non-contextual realist model, then this inequality holds. Okay? You take all the trace distances between the things that you want to be equal, and you put them in the equation, and you can see it adds something. All of these are greater than zero, so it's harder to violate the bound. And now you build your statistical test for this. Unfortunately, this contains absolute values, so it's a horrendous thing to do. But you can do it, and if you do an estimate here, a 99 point that many nines confidence interval, you get this interval for the data from that experiment. So if we assume that the errors that we see aren't fundamental, then this is actually below that bound still from that experiment. So you can do that. It gets a bit tricky to do the estimate, but it's not too difficult. So that's what I wanted to show. I think all of us want to get to the other part of the talk, right? Questions on this? Yes?
Why are you calling this maximally non-contextual? What's maximal?
Maximal is the probability that they're equal, actually.
Okay.
And the probability that they're equal equals one, that would be total non-contextuality, if you like. Yeah. Or non-contextual. Yeah. Yes?
What if the initial inequality is much more
complicated? I don't have a good answer for that. This would also be much more complicated. That's a fair answer.
I've been working on it, and I can answer you for particular scenarios.
Very good. Very good. Right, and now the quantum computation stuff. What people used to do here is to use stabilizer, sub-theories, inject magic states. The magic states you know are non-contextual. And I wanted to do something slightly different. I quite like Rob's model here, Rob's toy model. So I thought, this isn't quantum mechanics, but why don't I try to do something using that? Manually inject contextuality into Rob's toy model, and then see what can I do in quantum computation. So that was the idea. Manually inject here is actually Peres-Mermin state-independent contextuality. But I thought maybe there something happens, or I can do something more than just a plain model. So it's a decent question to ask, and it's not so hard to answer. And you all know the toy model, so I don't actually need to go through this. You've seen all these pictures. Yeah. I should say, now we're going to try to add Peres-Mermin contextuality here. So it's important what happens for the different in this table. I've just chosen one of the 10 different tables, and the results for the hashed marked state is this. So Z1 is plus 1, X2 is also plus 1, Z1 X2 is also plus 1, and then you just fill it in. If you do that then you get a contradiction to, well, you don't get the correct product here as regards the Peres-Mermin square. This is non-contextual, obviously. So if you do that for all the ontic states in the Peres-Mermin square, for all the measurements in the Peres-Mermin square for all the states in the toy model, this is the thing that appears to you. And what I did was I used electrical engineering nomenclature here. So we have a Mealy machine, a stochastic Mealy machine, with a state update rule that takes you from one state to another. If you measure this particular value, Z1, you update the state stochastically, either to the same state again, or to this state, where actually these four have changed the value. So the measurements that don't commute with the one you made changes the value, randomly. That's what happens. And this gives you a lot of things that you have in quantum mechanics. And the list is... you've seen this before. What you don't have usually in the toy model is contextuality, you don't have non-locality, you don't have the quantum computational speedup, or the continuum of states, or a number of other things. Yeah. And we're trying to add contextuality here. And we did that in a paper in 2011, and it's horrible. I won't go through the details. What happens is that you need to double the state space. And then you need to modify the state update rule so that a measurement inside this context where you get the wrong product takes you to a different state where the context in question has the right value, but then you need some other context to fail. So basically, the extra bit here is which context fails. And then you can just take the appropriate maps, and it becomes completely horrible. I also didn't include, so this is actually a stochastic map, so either you go to that state or this state with probability 1/2. You only need to go across from the red marked context. You don't need that for the others. But it works, and it gives you the Peres-Mermin contextuality. It gives you everything. In fact, you can do this with one bit more of memory. In fact, if you have all the 10 Peres-Mermin squares, between 60 and 768 states are sufficient, depending on what you require of the model. Right. Also, the knowledge balance principle becomes a knowledge imbalance principle, simply because you have more states. There's more knowledge here than you can actually extract in measurement. Okay, that's good. So we've added contextuality. This modified model is actually also manifestly non-local. If you split the two things and you make a measurement, then you need to actually change the data in both separate regions somehow, so it's manifestly not local. Okay, what about quantum computational speedup? Does anything happen when you do this? So we looked at the simplest possible algorithm, the Deutsch-Ossa algorithm. You have this unitary here that determines if f is balanced or constant. Actually, you can, if you don't use the Hadamards here, you can actually formulate this as a problem in classical computation too. Then you have F, and the map is the input passes through, the output gets added modulo 2, the output of the function. That's the map. And it turns out that one or two bit input functions, so if n is 1 or 2 here, you're in the Clifford group, so there's nothing strange going on at all. It's in the toy model as it is. So my question to my student, Niklas, was, what about 3-bit input functions? Can you do something about that using maybe the toy model or the toy model with the contextuality? It seemed like a fair question. And after 2 weeks, he came back and said, you don't need contextuality. And I said, what? Okay, then try 4. And after we'd worked together a bit, let's see if I can... Oh, yes. At this point, we had realized that this graphical language was kind of suboptimal. When he came back with the 3-bit thing, he had cubes. and arrows going back and forth. And at some point, when I said, let's try four, he said, well, I don't know really, do I want to do that? So what we did was we changed the notation. And this is actually something I would suggest you do too, because this simplifies enormously. The first paper we wrote on this particular issue was in the graphical language still. And the function maps and what we needed to do, it was pages. You take this state and do that and this, and like the beautiful pictures that you showed. Yeah. So what we did was, okay, so a toy system is actually two bits, a red and a blue bit, computational bit and phase bit. A measurement is simply a measurement of the computational bit and then a randomization of the phase bit. And then you can build up a Z operation. A transformation is just an inversion of the phase bit. An X is an inversion of the computational bit, nothing happens here. A Hadamard, which is in Matt Pusey's paper, I think, is shifting the two. So you actually shift. And this is natural, because that's what the intuition tells you in quantum mechanics. You shift the two. And a C-naught, a control X, explicitly now contains the phase kickback. So it's pretty, and it's easy to understand what's going on. Yeah.
Does it relate to Matt Pusey's stabilizer presentation of?
I think so. Yes, I think so.
Choose to represent with circuits.
Yeah. Maybe. I'm not quite sure what the equivalence is.
Have two wires.
Oh really? Okay.
It's different.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now, with that, we can actually do something here. We can say something about how these things work. Now, you know that 3-bit input or larger function oracles aren't. Some of the 3-bit inputs oracles are, but some of them are not. So what you need, well, you need a Toffoli gate. Now, what happened? Did I get the measurement device back?
I don't think so.
That disappeared. Okay, it's back there. Yeah. Okay, so you need to do something here. Yeah, you need to add the Toffoli gate to do something. So we did that. Our first attempt was, again, horrendously complicated, but then we came up with this. You just do the standard Toffoli and nothing on the phase. That seems completely trivial. But it turns out that 3-bit input oracles can be realized doing that, which is what he came back and said. I can do it if I just add this Toffoli gate. So there's a price for doing this. Yeah? You lose the knowledge balance principle. And you have something which is not quantum mechanical. The toy model is close to quantum mechanics. This is further away. Yeah. But I thought, okay, so why not? I was trying to do something which isn't quantum mechanics, so why would I try to stay close to quantum mechanics? Let's see what happens. And what happens is that I can actually, with this Toffoli, I can build any input oracles too. And the algorithm is actually just Hadamard's preparation and measurement. So the algorithm has the same complexity as the quantum algorithm. So suddenly, I've got a model that lets me realize input or n-bit input oracles for any function, and I can run it in polynomial time on a classical computer. I mean, this is a stochastic, what's it called? Turing machine. A probabilistic Turing machine, basically. Okay. Hmm. So how do we do that? Well, the oracles that we use look like this. There's a permutation of the not the bits, but actually the values themselves. So the input values, you permute them. So in such a way that the bit you're interested in, the output 1 or 0, gets moved to the lowest bit here. And then you just copy that out, and you get that on the function output, and then you invert the permutation. So you get the same value back. This is called and now I forgot it. It's Bennett's trick, Charlie Bennett's trick.
Phase kickback.
Well, yeah, the phase kickback is here. So the phase kickback here is actually what gets you the result. Yeah, but the construction of the function is called Bennett's trick. Yeah, you translate something which is irreversible to something which is reversible by calculating the value, copying it out, and then inverting the calculation. Yeah. In a paper from the 70s. The phase kickback is here, and it's explicit in our model. And as you can see, if you use the Toffoli that I was talking about, nothing will happen to the phase here. So in the Hadamard, the zero in the computational basis will be switched to the phase. Nothing will happen to it here. You will get the phase kickback, and then it'll get up into the computational basis, and you can measure it. And this looks trivially simple. Yeah. Our reaction was, why hadn't anybody thought of this before? If the function is constant, there's no C0 here, so you don't get the phase kickback either. Measurement after the final Hadamards will reveal whether it's balanced or constant, and the overhead is constant, a factor 2. Basically, it's the doubling of the controlled knots that does it. Yeah. Efficient. So, and now we put a paper on the archive. And immediately people start writing to us things like, oh, no, this is just wrong. This cannot be possible. There are theorems that state that you need exponentially many function calls in a classical computer. Which is true, there are theorems. Well, not for Deutsche OSA. You can actually do Deutsche OSA it's in BPP, you can do it in a polynomial time in a probabilistic computer. But this one run only, that's basically accepted as a theorem. So there is something here. It's also, sometimes it said, your oracle is too simple. You can just look here. If the C0 is there, then you've got a balanced function. If it's not, then you don't have a balanced function. You have a constant function. And sometimes you hear people say, for a quantum oracle, it's enough to generate a function map. That's what we need. And it's a unitary, so that gives us all the rest. I mean, you need some structure here, obviously. Yeah. So let me just talk about these three things in order. There are theorems. This theorem here is about Simon's algorithm, which I'll talk about later on. But it has the flavor of what I'm going to... all these reasons for doing this. It's a long theorem, and it says about Simon's algorithm that any classical computer, even a probabilistic classical computer, to have better than exponential failure probability, you need exponentially many function calls, even for a probabilistic Turing machine. The important detail is that the function is a map from 0, 1 to 0, 1 to the nth power, from bit strings to bit strings. This is verbatim from his paper. Now, you all know that quantum mechanics evades that theorem because it's not bit strings here, it's quantum bit strings, qubits. Our model also evades the theorem because We don't use bits, we use toy systems. So the theorem doesn't hold. None of the theorems hold.
Can you go over that again? What was the key difference?
For a theorem to hold, the input here, well, you don't have the Hadamard. Okay, so I should show. The input to the map that you're interested in has to be bits.
For a given qubit, the classical version has to be bits.
Yes, okay. Yes, exactly. While in the quantum version, it's a string of qubits. In our version, it's a string of toy systems, which is not one bit. A toy system, we're still obeying the rules of the toy theory in so much as we don't look at both the outputs at once. You can only extract one bit of information from each system. Okay.
So what is the description of the toy system in terms of bits?
Come again?
In terms of bits, how big is the toy system?
Twice. There's a factor 2.
Just factor 2?
Yes, a constant factor 2. It doesn't increase exponentially or polynomial or anything like that. It's a factor 2. Okay. Your oracle is too simple. You can just look here. If the x, the controlled x is not there, then it's a... Well, this algorithmic, it says, let O be an oracle constructed as follows, blah, 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 blah. What's important here is that the algorithm cannot look at the internals. It has to ask questions and then see what answers come out, and then draw conclusions based on the answers that come out. So basically, you're in the oracle paradigm. Yeah. And both Deutschosa and Simon's algorithm are oracle paradigm things. The theorems are relative to these things being black box oracles. Shor's algorithm is not like that. Okay. You also get people saying, for a quantum oracle, it's enough to generate the function map. Now, you know that this is not true. You need more than the function map. The quantum function map. What you actually need is that the phase is not influenced. That's what gives you the edge. This is the difficult part of quantum computation. If you don't ensure that, then you don't have the advantage. If you, for example, have a mixing map here, yeah. But it turns out it's not even enough to say, oh, you have this and it's a unitary. Because I could say, take the quantum unitary and put z's on the output. And then I get this map in the function. And you all know that this is the phase that you use at the end to actually give you the results. So what happens here in the thing is that this gets put in the phase gets zeroed, there's a zero phase here, so there's no phase kickback, and it gets restored afterwards. And suddenly, the Deutschosa algorithm fails. So you can't just have any map here, you actually need just that. This is crucial. That's what gives you the phase kickback. And if you look carefully in the details of our simulation, or our run of the algorithm, I don't know which, phase kickback, the presence of phase kickback, that's what forces us to use that particular structure. Because then, if we have that structure, then you've got phase kickback. So requiring this of the quantum algorithm actually requires the structure that you saw in our... It's the same requirement. It's the same requirement. So, in fairness, we should make the same requirements on the two calculational models. right? So n-bit input oracles can be realized. So this didn't surprise people so much, they said, because, okay, after all, there's a probabilistic Turing machine algorithm in polynomial time. You just call the function three times, and you have a high probability of guessing whether it's a balanced or a constant function. Yeah. So we thought, okay, so let's have something which is, there's a proper separation. Simon's algorithm. In Simon's algorithm, you have n bits in and n bits out. The function, the guarantee, the promise is such that the output is equal if there's a certain relation between the inputs. Yeah. Basically, you're trying to find the generator of an order 2 group. Unless S is 0, then these, it's if and only if. So then if S is 0, then F is a permutation of the elements, just. Okay. Your task is actually to find, is S 0 or non-zero? The quantum algorithm actually finds S in a linear number of calls. Yeah, that's what the algorithm does. And there's a proof that you need exponential number of classical function calls to have any decent probability of success. Yeah? And we just, what we did was we built one oracle that we found in the literature that had the similar structure to the one in Deutsche Ursa and ran it. And what happened was, what? It's still linear. And I won't show the details here, but they're in the paper. It's still linear. So for that, from that point of view, Simon's algorithm that we know is in BQP, but we thought there was a theorem that says it's not in BPP, in the oracle relativized setting, is suddenly in BPP.
Computer scientists won't like you saying that because they define that oracle very precisely so they can prove theorems.
Yes, but I've talked to computer scientists and there's nothing wrong with this kind of...
So you've changed your assumptions.
So how? So in again, to be fair, you do so when you go to quantum oracles as well. And my argument is that if we allow that, if we allow ourselves to say, okay, it's okay for it to be linear in quantum oracle calls, linear number of oracle calls, then it's linear in the other one.
I just say, I mean, the computer scientists define these things precisely for a reason.
Oh yeah, I know. There are oracles that separate P and NP. And there are oracles that tell you that P and NP are equal. My point is that I'm doing something which is manifestly classical here, but has the same properties as the quantum stuff that we are used to. Okay. And here's the theorem. I won't spend that so much time on that. At this point, people say, what about Shor's algorithm? And now it gets exciting. In Shor's algorithm, you have a different kind of, well, you have an oracle. Your task is to find the period of the function, a to the x mod n. Yeah. So you're still looking for a hidden structure, a generator of a group. And if you don't compile the circuitry, then factoring 15 even is outside the Clifford group. So usually they say factoring 15 is the first non-trivial example. Okay, so this is what Shor's algorithm would look like. If your base is 8 and you've got 2 input qubits, so 8 times 8 mod 15 times 8 squared mod 15. Actually, if you run Shor's algorithm, you need 8 qubits in here because something called Fourier spread will spread out the points where the period appears in the output. But it turns out that 8 to the 4th power is 1. So this is popular among experimentalists because you don't need to build more functions here. It stops. The sequence stops. So you don't need to have 8 input bits, you only need 2. Yeah. And as you can see, this is a Fredkin gate, so that's why I sent a Fredkin gate around before. You needed to build a Fredkin gate. We can build Fredkin gates using the Toffoli. What happens here is that, come on, this Toffoli doesn't work. Because as you can see, there's no phase kickback at all, and these are just controls, and there's no phase kickback, so it won't work. And then we thought, maybe we should do something more, slightly more complicated, but not that much more complicated. Let's do something which is logical. Let's have something that looks like a quantumly controlled C0. Right? So this is the map. And this becomes very easy in this notation, and it becomes very, very ugly and complicated in the sort of cube that you have otherwise. And this works. And what do you do now if you're a professor in an electrical engineering department? Well, of course, you build the thing. It's not just because I'm in an electrical engineering department. What happened was that people don't believe that this works. So let's do an experiment, and then you need hardware. Yeah. You need hardware. It looks like this when you couple it. And this is actually, so this is times 8. That's the controlling qubit. And here's the readout for that qubit. The other qubit takes 8 squared, the multiplication 8 squared modulo 15. And then there's a readout, and then there's a classical control for the... you need a 90-degree rotation, and I have it here. I didn't explain how it works, but we have one. And you run the experiment. And this is the sort of output statistics of the thing. I should say the sources and the measurement devices have a random number generator each. So what you're seeing is statistics from the random number generators, and it's nearly perfect. Nearly perfect. We did a reasonably good job in implementing this. But you can see there are some systematic errors here. And that's good. Why is it good? Because it means that there's something still we haven't really... We're not close enough to the quantum mechanical behavior to be able to factor properly. We can run small examples. These systematic errors increase when you increase the size. And it's because our Toffoli isn't a quantum Toffoli. Yeah? My initial question when I started this was, how much contextuality do you need? And we're not seeing any sign of needing anything like that. I think that these systematic errors depend on something else. And we have good ideas what it is. And I should tell you, I think personally we won't be able to factor. I still think that there is something that quantum mechanics does better than we will be able to do. But I'm not sure. Because I didn't think that this would even get off the ground. I didn't think that we would be able to do the chosen. So I was I sat up straight when he said, I can do it. So the errors here are smaller than any state-of-the-art experiment. We haven't looked so much, but the most recent papers we looked at have higher standards. I forget what this is, SSO, it's some statistical measure they like to use, I don't particularly like. But these numbers are higher than the experiments that you see. Even this one, which is fairly far away from the equal, it's supposed to be uniform over the 4 points, but it's not. But the squared statistical overlap, that's the name, yeah, is rather high. So the experiment we found, the worst case scenario for them was 0.9, roughly. I expect they'll beat us soon, but... If I'd sold you this, you'd be very, very suspicious, because it seems to be too good. The Dirichlet and Simons algorithm can be run efficiently with zero error. It always gives you the right answer. It also always gives you the right forward map. The function map is always correct. The function you were trying to implement, you do implement. Shor's algorithm can be run efficiently. I should say, we can build the large gate arrays. It's just that you get larger and larger errors. So it depends on what you mean here. We can build the gate array, but we don't solve the problem, so to speak. So efficiently is a bit of a fishy thing there. And it contains the toy model, so all of the effects that you know and love are in there. You have non-commuting measurements, uncertainty, interference, you can do remote steering, dense coding, you can do teleportation with the kit. And so on and so on. If you remove the Toffoli so that you still have knowledge balance, then you have no cloning and no broadcasting and these other results. You can even do the BB84 quantum key distribution. You won't have any security because the bits are represented in electrical signals, but you can actually run a demo. You can even run a demo where you use a CNOT to copy your quantum information and then just measure on the ancilla. And you'll see the disturbance at Bob. So it's a neat thing. You can use it as a teaching tool if you like. And later this fall, you'll be able to buy it.
How much?
Between 2,000 and 8,000 euros, depending on what you want to do. I need to count how many gates you need to do basically all the bases in Shor's algorithm, and then I'll be able to sell you a kit that does Shor's algorithm for 15. It's not quantum, and it won't give you the right distribution, but it'll give you the right answer. Actually, what happens is that the errors are such that you get the right answer for Shor's algorithm. That's neat. And will we be able to factor large numbers? Well, I sort of doubt it, but you never know. You never know. Okay, so that's what I had to say. Thank you very much.
I liked your new graphical notation for the toy theory. You only showed sort of real operations.
Yes.
So how would you do like the measurement that in the normal box thing corresponds to sort of a diagonal, the thing that's like measuring in the y direction?
The y direction, you can do that. The thing is, I haven't done it in the kit because we're thinking about better ways to do the y than are actually in the toy model, because the y is coupled to x and z in a way that you don't see in quantum mechanics always. So we didn't include that, but you can do it in the toy model version, and it would look like there would be... what I do remember is that a Y gate, very good, very good, would be, now I have the red on the bottom, I think, like this. So that's a Y gate, and if you want to do like a Hadamard, but shift the other, probably will just draw it wrongly. But it's there. You can do it, sure.
Maybe my follow-up question, though, is that with maybe just looking at the ones that you did show,
yeah,
sort of a real version of the toy theory,
yes,
maybe that is exactly maps onto real rebit stabilizer theory. So there's the toy theory of qubits doesn't give you quantum mechanics. It's a bit different, but if you restrict to the real ones, you get rebit stabilizer theory. I'm sort of looking at models.
Oh, you get the CSS. You get the CSS.
You have local Hadamards there. So in the rebit theory, you're only allowed like global Hadamards.
Yeah.
So if they have local Hadamards, it's not the same.
In textbooks, typically when they present Simon's algorithm or the Deutsch-Rush algorithm, they typically talk about the classical version that would, what a classical computer would do. And typically the classical versions generate the outputs to all the functions, and the quantum versions don't.
Yes.
So this yours?
No. It doesn't. What happens, and this is something I meant to mention but didn't. What happens is that if you look at, I'll do something else here. If you look at the function itself, what you see is the relation between function input and output pointwise. And that's what a classical function does. It gives you a point. And what you're after here is a general structural property of the function. Is it a balanced or a constant function? Now, what happens here is that the Hadamard sort of rotates the output so that you see the structure of the function rather than the individual values. And that's what I want to point to here. The map here talks about the internal structure of the function, not the individual outputs for the relation between x and f of x. And that's really what you do when you look at the phase basis in a quantum computational algorithm, would be my argument. It reveals the structure.
Okay, here. In the case of the one qubit and two qubit cases, I saw that the Deutsch-Jones algorithm could be simulated, and I asked computer scientists about this, and to my mind, it came down to the fact that comparisons between the power of a quantum computer and classical computer for Oracle problems require you to say something about what's the classical equivalent of a given quantum Oracle.
Yes.
And from a foundational perspective, the question I should have been asking is, you give me a quantum Oracle, tell me how it works. Now, I go looking for a classical model, which allows a qubit to be represented by some logic state space, maybe, and some arbitrary transformation on that. But instead, they just said, no, the classical Oracle is just a single bit coming in, but that's the equivalent of a qubit, and it's just evaluating the function. Done. And if you say, okay, that's the power, those are the Oracles I give my classical computer, but I give the quantum Oracles to my quantum computer, which are evaluating the thing. I mean, it's just a very unfair comparison. So you've given your classical computer this bum Oracle that is very cool, and you've given your quantum computer this nice one. And it turns out that if you just said, oh, the classical analog of the quantum Oracle is a two classical bit input, two classical bit output, and in your notation, it just flips the second bit. So it's very easy to see. It flips it if it's balanced, and it doesn't flip it if it's constant. And so you just measure that bit, and you figure it out. So I think it says something deep about the failure. I mean, if we're going to compare classical and quantum, we have to be more sophisticated when we talk about Oracle problems.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
So just following that question. So this means that actually your function works only for class of oracles that we are able to build, right? Because there are some oracles, I understand, that are, from the computer science perspective, very complicated, right? Those ones that are separating the classes.
Yes, well...
So in that sense, I'm saying that wouldn't probably... from a practical point of view, it's like this machine works for... let's put the following question. Does it work for an Oracle?
I have... I have several oracles in this model for every map, for every F. So I don't know how to answer that better. The difference between this and Shor's algorithm is that in Shor's algorithm you have a specific recipe on how to build the oracle. Yeah? So you follow that. And in this case, what happens is that you don't get exactly the quantum behavior. You get the right answer, but that's beside the point. Maybe that's... So I would say in the Oracle, black box Oracle setting, this is not the problem, but when you go to some real-life problem like Shor's algorithm, where you obtain N, and then you build your gate array, then it's important.
So this Oracle discussion, I think what the Oracle models is that you have some function that is hiding a linear structure. Like, you know that the function is hiding some period, and your goal is to find the period. So in the Simon's algorithm is similar, it's hiding a shift within set 2n.
Yes.
But it naturally models a situation where someone gives you a function that has a symmetry, and your goal is to find the symmetry. As a short algorithm, it is not easy to find the period of number multiplied by n. So what the Oracle here is modeling is that you can actually find a map or isomorphism that transforms the Oracle into a Clifford circuit. And I talk about that in my thesis a bit. But it is impossible to find that efficiently using a classical computer. Like, well, actually, in the Oracle model, you're not even given access to the function. So if you want to do that, it will take exponential time.
Yes.
So it's kind of, when you open the Oracle, the complexity classes change. And
yes.
You cannot compare anything.
Yes, yes. True.
Comments and a question. So the comment is just, I would just suggest not to antagonize the computer scientists too much, because you know, they've defined oracles their way for a reason.
Yeah.
And I think from that perspective, the chain of logic would start with the classical oracle, which is limited, prove its limitations, then consider a coherent quantum version and study the differences.
Yes.
So this is, it's a different sort of classical implementation of the oracle. It's actually a different classical oracle.
It's a different thing.
So you can't really directly compare them. If you start talking about complexity classes, you have to be careful about what you're actually saying. Because you're not quite comparing like with like.
Well,
but I do think it's very enlightening to to look at it like this, and I think it's I think there's a lot of
it does run on a classical computer.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's not the oracle that they studied in their theorems.
No. So, but that's what I was saying.
I mean,
it's
an interesting question to ask. You know, whether the quantum coherent version of that really is equivalent, and that's a is an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
It's also an interesting discussion to look at how oracles are implemented.
Yes.
I mean, if you go on IBM's website at the moment, they're demoing their 5-qubit quantum computer. And one of the things they do there is an implementation of a Grover search, a single Grover search that works all the time.
Mm.
And if you have a look at the circuits, I showed this to a bright student, and they came back to me saying, well, this is cheating. It works because you're putting the answer in.
Yes.
And the very construction of that oracle in that Grover search algorithm makes it look like, because this algorithm is so simple, makes it look like you're putting things in by hand.
Yes.
So I think this reveals that possibility very, very nicely.
Mm.
But my question is about the Shor's algorithm, which is very intriguing that you're seeing this sort of similarity, but not quite the same as Shor's algorithm. And I guess this is reflecting how you're not quite representing the quantum theory anymore.
Yes.
And I'm intrigued as to where that's gone. Have you looked at any, I mean, do you have a general sense in how this is departing from the quantum computational model, and what happens when you go to large n?
I do, but I don't want to go into that.
I mean, in a sense, what
let me tell you one of the problems we have. If we, by chance, by randomly mucking about with these things, suddenly find a way to factor efficiently.
Oh my God.
What do we do?
You have to report it.
Yes, I know the laws. I know the laws of Sweden.
I don't know about you guys, but I remember when I worked out the situation just a long ago, and then it was a special, this works for faxing, and I remember sort of lying there at night, kind of like in cold sweat, what? I don't believe it, but it's sort of a frightening thought.
Yes, it is a frightening thought. And that's why I'm saying I don't think we'll be able to do it, because then I'm safe. Yes?
This is the description of this is of course finite, right? So if one thinks in terms of Turing machine,
yeah.
So you can encode it into the Turing machine.
Yeah, sure.
So the question is, if you encode it to the Turing machine, so there are binary representation of the Turing machine.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the question is why those theorems like that one for that you have they do not work and. You partially answered that to that question because you said that somehow the information is spread, it's not local in a sense, it's not local enough in that network,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to know to what extent one could see the difference while trying to encode it really into bits, just description step by step, because you could do this, right? So then the interactions between those bits that you're writing down to write down the steps after step, they probably should be very much complicated from the perspective of classical computer science, right? And that would be instructive.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to respond to that, unfortunately. I could say one thing more. We've written computer code for this also. And we've run instances of the Deutsch-Ossa algorithm with 100,000 bits as input. And for the Simons algorithm, I remember it was something like 10,000 bits or something like that. So it really, that sort of convinced me that it worked. It didn't convince the referee.
So I guess that's more questions, but it's getting late. And
it's,
so why don't the rest of the questions come up afterwards, and
okay.
Let's thank Yanaki again, and I'll see you.